wealthy husband. I'm saying... He paused, brow momentarily furrowed. I'm saying I don't want you to go to a workhouse.
Me either, I admitted.
Here was that precipice, and the choice was solely on me. Grit my teeth and push on to Adoria, or skulk back to Osfrid. Fine. I'll go play the game and get ready. I started to turn toward the door, and he blocked my way.
Adelaide, I'm sorry. I really am.
I know, I said. I am too. But it can't change anything. Back in the Glittering Courts wing, I found girls rushing between their own rooms and the common room, everyone too busy with hair and clothing to stop and speak to me. Few made eye contact, though I noted several giving me sidelong glances when they thought I didn't see. In my room, I found Mira buttoning up her overdress. It was made of a rich scarlet satin embroidered with golden flowers. Silk petticoats in that same gold flashed underneath the dress. She looked exotic and mysterious. Seeing me, she instantly stopped buttoning and swept me into her arms. I leaned into her and had to fight the tears back again. "You have no problem doing this?" I asked. With her independent streak, I'd almost expected her to rebel too. "Of course I do," she said matter-of-factly. As I studied her more closely, and took in the emotion in her eyes and lines of her face, I realized that her calm tone masked a swelling of rage and sorrow. She was just better at keeping it locked down than I was. "But getting shipped back to Osfrid isn't going to accomplish anything. I need to go forward. Get to the next stage. And you do, too." I pulled back and nodded.
"I know.
And I mean, I really do understand what I signed on for. I want to do it. But Tamsin..." I started to choke up, unable to go on. Mira squeezed my hand.
"I know," she said. "I feel the same way. But it's not your fault."
Cedric had said the same thing. I couldn't believe either of them. But I followed Mira's lead, trying to go forward and on to the next stage. I put on a gown of grey velvet, worn over a chemise and petticoats of purest white. Bows of glittering silver decorated the sleeves and bodice, and a shawl of white lace covered my shoulders. The shawl would do little against the damp, cold weather, but Jasper had been adamant we not go out covered in heavy cloaks. We pulled our hair up into elaborate buns and chignon, and my wavy hair allowed fine tendrils to frame my face. On board the ship, fires were limited, so those who didn't have naturally curly hair couldn't heat up the curling wands we usually used. Miss Bradley assured us that even if we weren't done up to our regular level of precise detail, we were still by far and away more than what usually came ashore in Denham Colony. By the time we'd finished and come up to the deck, the Good Hope had nearly reached the docks. Sailors and the other passengers stopped and stared. My grief still weighed heavily on me, but I kept my expression cool as I assessed the approaching shore. Triumph Bay was a huge expanse of water, enclosed by land that hooked around it. Cape Triumph was located on the inside of the top of the hook. A great deal of our education had focused on the strategic location of this large port city, in an area protected from the worst of sea storms, creating safe waters for docking ships. The rest of Denham was accessible overland or by sailing along the coast. Opposite the city, on the far side of the bay, lay uncolonized lands whose rocky shore made docking more difficult. I again studied the large and towering trees, many still standing despite years of colonists clearing them for lumber and farmland. This close, I could see some of the city's buildings now. I couldn't help but feel fascinated, despite my desire to remain indifferent. There was an entirely other feel compared to Osfro. There, in Osfrid's capital city, everything was old. Stone castles and churches that had been around for centuries marked the skyline, surrounded by well-established wooden houses and shops that were sometimes fortified with stone or brick. Of course, new construction and renovation took place all the time, but Osfro's overall feel was one of solidity and prestigious antiquity. Cape Triumph was new. Hardly any buildings had that venerable feel. Most were made of wood, with the planks' light color showing their young age. Much was still under construction, as Cape Triumph grew in size and importance. None of the buildings, even some of the older ones, were very tall. There were no castles here as a memory of ages past. The largest structure I could see was a fort far off on a hill, and it too was mostly made of fresh timbers. That lack of stone, that lack of wear, it made everything feel so young. With such newness and instability, it seemed as though this town was fighting fiercely for its survival. A crowd had gathered at the wharves, by far and away made up of men. These docks, too, had that same young feel, though some aspects were the same as in Osfrid's ports. Water lapped against the wooden posts, darkened by the grey sky overhead. The smell of fish and refuse washing up to shore filled the air. The sailors tied up our ship, and much went into securing it before we were allowed to disembark. By then the crowd had further increased. I could see men dressed in finery, who might very well be legitimate suitors, lined up with those in common clothes, who'd simply come to see the show. All wore heavy cloaks and coats against the weather, and I regarded them with envy as a bitter wind cut through me. A group of burly men with guns strode up to the dock, and Jasper walked down to meet them. I gathered by what little of the conversation I could hear that these were men hired by Jasper to see us around safely. While I was used to being escorted in Osbro, seeing that squad of rough-and-tumble men drove home what a different world we were in. I dreamed of the excitement and adventure of Adoria, but this was still a dangerous and untamed place. When we were given permission to leave, Miss Bradley lined us up and put me at the head of the line. "You're the diamond," she explained. "You must be the lead." I stared, speechless. I didn't fear the attention exactly, but after everything I'd been through, this seemed like too much. Before I could protest, Mira asked, "Why are you putting me third?" Miss Bradley fixed her with a look both hard and sad. "Because you are third now. Everyone else above you was on the Grey Gull." The world swayed around me, as thoughts of Tamsin and that ship bobbing like a toy filled my mind. "Adelaide," said Miss Bradley, "you need to go. Now." I shook my head, rooted to the spot, and then I felt Cedric's steady presence beside me. "Follow me," he said. "We're just going straight to my father, that's all. Keep your eyes ahead." He walked down the dock, and after a few deep breaths, I worked up the resolve to follow. My legs felt unsteady at first, accustomed to weeks in a rocking ship. Solid ground had become a foreign thing. I kept my eyes focused on Cedric's back as I put one foot in front of the other and tried to block out the gawkers around me. Even though I knew there was a whole line of other girls following me, I felt alone and vulnerable. Jasper on the far side of the crowd might as well have been miles away. His men had cleared a space where the dock ended, glaring threateningly at anyone who dared take a step closer. But that didn't stop the whistles or catcalls.
"Hey, girlie, hike up that skirt and show us what a real jewel looks like." And, "Did they bring that Sir Minikin for the rest of us? When do I get my turn?"
were only a few of the taunts. An angry flush swept over me, offering a small warmth against the cold. My rage was directed not just at the uncouth men, but also at Jasper. Surely there were better ways of acquiring husbands for us than parading us around like the livestock Mira had remarked upon. All that training and culture, the alleged improvement of our minds, meant nothing when we were put on display in this wild land and judged by our looks alone. And yet, was it any different than when I'd been shown off in the grand ballrooms of Osfro? Would this always be a woman's lot? I had half an urge to tear the expensive clothing and dishevel the carefully styled hair. Instead, I held my head high and followed the scarlet of Cedric's cloak. I wished I hadn't packed his dagger away in my trunk, not because I intended to use it, but simply because feeling the cold blade against my skin seemed comforting. "I'm better than these people," I told myself. "Not because of my bloodline, but because of my character." At last, after what probably only lasted a few minutes, I made it to Jasper. He stood with more of his men and some carriages, which were thankfully enclosed. Jasper nodded in approval. "Excellent! Excellent!" he said, beckoning us to the coaches. I can already see the potential buyers. I suppose having half the set might drive up the prices. I came to a halt, my jaw dropping. Mira pushed me on, into the coach. How can you ignore that? I exclaimed to her as we took our seats. Surely even her tight control had its limits. I'm not ignoring it, she said, rubbing her ankle. Fury simmered in her eyes, but I pick my battles. Nothing can change what happened. Nothing's going to change his nature. But we can control our futures. That's what we must focus on. I leaned back against the seat, wrapping my arms around myself. Now that the tension of that terrible procession was gone, the cold was hitting me again. I strived to be as calm as Mira, but it was hard. I wanted to go back outside and scream at Jasper, letting out all the tumultuous emotions trapped within me. But it wouldn't bring back Tamsin, or the Grey Gull. So I sat in seeming complacency, letting my feelings boil within me. Two other girls joined us, and the carriage started off. I'd noted the lack of cobblestone streets here, even in a busy part of the city. The storm we'd faced had brought rain here, and I could feel the carriage struggle through the irregular, muddy roads. Once our driver had to stop and get one of our escorts to help release a stuck wheel. By the time we reached our lodging, it was late afternoon. Our temporary home in Adoria was a house called Wisteria Hollow. It seemed small and plain after the venerable Blue Spring, but I was told that by Adorian standards it was a grand residence. It boasted a rare 3 floors and had real glass windows, which were also uncommon in Adoria. The land had mostly been cleared around it, but a few apple trees grew prettily near the front door, as well as the wisteria that gave the place its name. The wisteria vines were brown and the buds on the apple trees were barely discernible, unlike the fuller ones back in Osfrid. Adoria's more severe climate brought a slightly later spring. Warmth hit us inside the house, and we were finally offered blankets and cloaks to shake off the cold. A middle-aged woman with tightly bound dark hair and a pointed chin waited in the foyer, along with a well-dressed older man in spectacles. He embraced Jasper and Cedric, and I realized this must be Charles Thorne. He beamed at all of us, until Jasper murmured something in his ear. Charles paled, and I realized he was learning about the Grey Gull. "This is a tragedy beyond words," he said. Jasper nodded, but then shared his earlier revelation. "Indeed, it will increase the demand for this group." Cedric shot his father a withering look and then turned to Charles. "Uncle, we told the girls they could have some time before beginning their social season." "Yes, yes, certainly," said Charles, nodding his head. "My poor Jules, of course you must recover. But then you will have such fun once the season begins. Your promenade was only a taste of the delights to come." Mira and I exchanged glances at that. Charles had seemed totally sincere. He might be more kind-hearted than his brother, but he was also obviously more naive about the glamorous lives we lived. I could understand why Jasper was the dominant force in this business. "This is Mistress Culpepper," said Miss Bradley, nodding to the woman with the pointed chin. This felt vaguely like my arrival at Blue Spring. Mistress Culpepper looked us over with a critical eye. "No doubt many of you think the New World is a looser place, where you will be allowed to run wild. But not while I am in charge of this house. You will follow all rules I set, and adhere to their every detail. There will be no inappropriate or uncouth behaviour under my roof." I stared. Had she never seen the procession by the docks? Did she really think we were the ones who might be uncouth? The Thorns and a few of the hired men had lodging in a downstairs wing. Our rooms were on the upper floors. We would have normally been placed 3 or 4 to a room, but with our numbers reduced, we were being roomed in 2s. I was grateful I'd have privacy with Mira, but it only served as another slap in the face about Tamsin's fate. "Change and rest," Charles told us cheerily. "We'll have supper soon, and then help you prepare for the social season to come. Then, my jewels, the real fun will begin." Chapter 13. I don't know if it was Jasper's intent or not, but our mourning period ended up being a good business move. Our disappearance after that initial procession drove our prospective suitors into a frenzy. They'd seen us once and wanted to see more. Jasper, realizing the advantage this presented, became enigmatic about when our ball season would begin. Our mystique increased, and messengers constantly came on behalf of their masters, looking for more information. And soon the masters themselves began to arrive. I was one of the most despondent over the Grey Gull's loss, but even I couldn't keep my curiosity at bay. The Thorns had a private office downstairs, but would meet prospective clients in a luxury sitting room with a high ceiling that was open on one side to a walkway above. Here we could crouch in the shadows behind a slatted railing and covertly observe the goings-on below. With no other contact with the outside world, aside from outlandish stories about pirates and Ikori that our guards carried to us, this became grand entertainment for us. I welcomed the distractions, though they could never keep Tamsin far from my thoughts. Some of the suitors came with general inquiries, and the Thorns slipped into their best sales modes to suggest possible matches to these suitors. Cedric was excellent at this, and not even Jasper could fault him. I was reminded of the Cedric from our first meeting, rather than the troubled religious dissident I'd come to know. "Well, Mr. Collins, a magistrate like you needs to be especially mindful of the kind of wife he chooses," Cedric said to an inquiring gentleman one day. Several of us were crowded above, trying to get a good view. A magistrate was of particular interest to us. "I've put it off," the man admitted. He seemed to be older than us, mid-30s, if I had to guess. Cedric was handling the meeting alone, as was common. "I had been in talks with Harold Stone about his daughter, but then you arrived." "I know of Mr. Stone," Cedric said. "Good man, from what I hear. Successful farm, right? And I'm guessing his daughter is a pleasant, respectable girl, raised and educated at home, with good values." "Yes," Mr. Collins spoke warily, uncertain of where Cedric was leading. "But is a pleasant farmer's daughter really going to help you get where you need to go?" What do you mean?" asked Mr. Collins. Cedric gestured grandly. "Look at you. You're a man in your prime, your career still rising. Is magistrate the most you want to achieve? There are almost certainly higher posts in the government that you'd be in the running for, in Denham and in some of the other fledgling colonies where they need capable men the most. A man hoping to rise needs to stand out. He needs every advantage he can get, including his choice of wife." Mr. Collins fell silent for several moments. "And you have someone in mind who would be suitable for this?" Cedric's back was to me, but I could picture his winning smile. "I have several." He picked up a stack of papers and rifled through them. "Why, there's Sylvia, a petite brunette who charms everyone she knows. Received very high marks in social planning. Exactly who you'd want to arrange dinners and parties to impress your friends. And then we've got Rosamond. Golden blonde hair, excellent knowledge of history and political affairs. She can hold her own in any conversation with the elite classes, in a genteel, ladylike way, of course." Sylvia and Rosamond, sitting near me, leaned forward eagerly. "I do like blondes," said Mr. Collins grudgingly. "Is she pretty?" "Mr. Collins, I assure you they're all pretty. Beautiful. Stunning. Men are still reeling from the day they arrived in Cape Triumph." "I wasn't there, but I've heard the stories." Mr. Collins took a deep breath. "How much would someone like this Rosamond cost?" "Well," said Cedric, again going through the papers, I knew it was for show. He had all of our dossiers memorized, and tended to make recommendations based on which girls simply hadn't been pitched to prospective clients, in an effort to give us all exposure. I had yet to be suggested. "Her starting price would be $200 gold dollars.
200!
Exclaimed Mr. Collins. "She'd cost 200 gold. "Her starting price would, due to her rank. That number can easily go up if enough gentlemen bid and want to catch her attention. Between you and me," Cedric leaned toward the other man conspiratorially, "well, there's been a lot of interest this week. Like you, many gentlemen are partial to blondes." I'd only heard Cedric pitch Rosamond as one of many other choices, but the idea that she was in demand was alluring to Mr. Collins.
"That's a lot of money," he said uncertainly.
"That's an investment," corrected Cedric. I couldn't help but smile. He was so charming, so self-assured. He probably could have sold Mr. Collins on buying 10 wives.
"Tell me, when the governor hosts a formal dinner and has a new position to fill, what will his wife, a baron's daughter, I hear, report back after conversing with Mr. Stone's daughter? And should one of His Majesty's royal ambassadors visit, scrutinizing how well the new world is keeping pace with the old one, what will he say when he meets a farmer's daughter? Will she be able to discuss arts and music? Be well informed on the intricacies of Denham politics? You yourself are of middle-class upbringing, I understand. You've certainly surpassed that. But I imagine a young woman skilled in aristocratic ways could be very useful to you as you navigate political waters.
Cedric's body language reminded me of some predatory animal, braced and ready for his prey to show a sign of weakness so that he could move in for the attack. Mr. Collins fell silent once more. At last he said, "May I see her?"
"Of course, at our opening ball with everyone else. I'll make sure you're on our invitation list when we announce it."
And that was how he left most of the men hanging, tantalizing them with the idea of a girl who was perfect for them, but in demand by so many others. These gentlemen left consumed by the idea, soon imagining far more about us than Cedric could ever describe. We'd been there about a week and a half when Cedric finally found a chance to pull me aside for a private conversation. "The painting and supplies are in the large cellar. Do you think you can find a chance to sneak in and finish?" The painting had been nearly complete when the storm hit, needing only a few last touches. "If I can escape Mistress Culpepper, she watches everything we do, much more than Mistress Masterson ever did." He nodded. "I'll find a way to get her out one afternoon. Tell her we need some emergency cloth or supplies for some girl or another. It's not entirely hard to believe. The opening ball is at the end of this week."
"Is it?" I asked.
I'd known this lull couldn't last forever, but was still startled.
"The announcement's being made tomorrow.
This place'll be chaos as Mistress Culpepper gets you all ready. It should be easy enough for you to slip away. There'll be last-minute wardrobe problems and more men coming by to make another attempt at a private meeting before everyone gets a shot at you all." I gave him a sidelong look.
"Why don't you ever pitch me?"
"What?" "I've watched most of your meetings. You rotate through all the girls, making sure each one gets highlighted to some suitor or another, but never me."
"I'm sure I have,"
he said lightly. "You probably just missed those particular meetings."
I found that unlikely.
I'd watched almost all, and when I didn't, there was always some girl more than willing to rehash every single detail of the conversation. Before I could protest, Mistress Culpepper came hurrying into the dining room.
"Mr. Thorne, there's a gentleman here to speak with you."
It was the first time I'd seen her look unsettled. Cedric raised an eyebrow. "I didn't think we had any appointments this afternoon."
"We don't, but, sir, it's the governor's son, Warren Doyle."
That caught even Cedric off guard.
"Well then, I guess you'd better show him to the sitting room."
She hurried off, and he glanced at me.
"And I suppose you'd better scurry off to your spy post."
I flashed him a grin and left the room. As I went upstairs, I caught sight of Jasper nearly running into the house. Apparently word of the governor's son's visit had reached him. He might normally have no problem letting Cedric handle meetings alone, but this was clearly one Jasper wanted to be at. All the girls gathered on the walkway above, even Mira, who tended to skip these covert viewings. We craned our necks, hoping to get a glimpse of the suitor who had caused both Cedric and Jasper to take notice.
"Not bad," murmured Clara.
I had to agree. Warren Doyle was only a few years older than us, something of a relief, since many grey-haired gentlemen had graced our door. Even from this height, I could see a face with strong, handsome features, and jet-black hair pulled back into the short, fashionable tail popular on both sides of the Sunset Sea.
"Mr. Doyle," said Jasper, taking the newcomer's hand.
It is an honor.
Call me Warren, please. We might as well drop formalities since I plan on being quite straightforward here. It's how I am. And, well, I hope you'll forgive me. I'm no good with small talk. Jasper exchanged the briefest of looks with his son, and then returned his smile to Warren. Of course. Please, sit down. Warren did, clasping his hands in his lap. A daytime visit would have allowed more casual attire, but he was dressed formally, in a russet coat and a vest of gold brocade. He could have attended our ball right now. I'm here about one of your girls. The top one. The one who led your procession, in the grey dress. I tensed. Do you mean Adelaide? Asked Cedric uncertainly. Is that her name? Asked Warren, brightening. She is the best one, right? Isn't that how your ranking works? She had brown hair. Well, a golden brown. Very lovely. Mira grinned beside me. You got your hair right. That should make you happy. Best is a subjective term, said Jasper delicately. All of our girls are... Warren smiled kindly. You don't need to use your usual tactics on me. You don't need to try to sell them all to me. I'm already sold. I want her. I need her. You see, I've been given governorship of the new colony of Hadison. Jasper beamed, but I knew how he must be calculating. Congratulations! That's an incredible accomplishment for a man of your age, if you don't mind me saying so. Thank you, said Warren, nodding eagerly. I'm very, very fortunate, and that's why it's imperative I have an exemplary wife. She will be the first lady of the colony. Even in its rough stages, all will look to her as an example. And once we're truly established, she'll be the one in charge of all social affairs in my household. I need someone who excels in all areas, someone intelligent, cultured, and worthy of admiration. I assume as your top girl, a diamond, corrected Jasper. We call her a diamond. Your diamond, then. I assume she must have surpassed all the others in every test. If I am to succeed in this venture, I must have an incomparable lady. I could feel the eyes of my companions upon me, trying to gauge my reaction. Mostly, I was stunned. After never hearing my name come up, I was shocked at this turn of events. There could be no greater position than a governor's wife. And it hadn't escaped my notice that it had been my inner qualities and aptitude that caught his attention as much as my looks. Most of the men who'd come through here had made beauty a top priority. "She is certainly incomparable," said Jasper. He managed to keep the sarcasm out of his voice. "And I'll tell you a secret. Our opening ball is coming soon, so you only have to wait a few days to meet her." "I don't really need to meet her," said Warren. "I'm sure she's exceptional. And I'd like to seal a marriage contract now."
That's not how it works, said Cedric, stiffly. The girls meet all potential suitors in our social season. Then they choose.
Warren was undaunted.
I don't want to risk losing her to someone who might woo her with a lot of flash and no substance. I'll put out a price to make it worth your while for removing her early.
One I might not be willing to match if I have to wait.
1,000 gold. If you do the deal right now.
Some of the girls near me gasped. There'd never been a sum like that offered in the Glittering Court's history. It was double my starting fee. Even Jasper couldn't believe it.
That is a very generous sum, Mr. Doyle. Warren.
I know what I'm asking is unorthodox, explained Warren, almost sheepishly. And that's why I'm willing to compensate, for altering your policy.
Understandable, said Jasper, practically licking his lips, and very considerate.
Our policy, declared Cedric, shooting his father a warning glance, is that she gets to see her options and choose. We can't just sell her behind her back.
I wouldn't dream of it, said Warren. He seemed a little taken aback by Cedric's tone.
I can meet her today, and then seal our deal.
It would be a breach of our normal policy, said Jasper, but I'm sure, given the circumstance, there'd be no harm in her at least meeting him now, and...
She gets to see her options and choose, repeated Cedric.
It's in her contract. No preemptive deals. I could tell Jasper was having a very difficult time maintaining his genial facade. He turned to Warren. Forgive me. It's clear this is a matter we must discuss at more length. Let us do so, and we'll be in touch once we've made some decisions. Warren looked hesitant about leaving with things up in the air, but finally gave a conciliatory nod. Very well, then. I look forward to your reply, and an early meeting before the ball. Thank you again for indulging me in my unorthodox approach. As soon as the Thorns had walked him out, Jasper pulled Cedric into their private office and shut the door. The rest of us retreated to our wing, where I was immediately accosted with questions and comments. I had no answers to give, and the chatter soon began to make my head ache. It was a relief when I was able to shut myself in my room with Mira. She gave me a sly smile. Well, she said, that was certainly an exciting turn to the day. I stretched out on my bed, still reeling. That's an understatement. What will you do? She asked. I don't think I can do anything. The Thorns will decide. She sat down beside me. If you went downstairs right now and said you'd take the deal, there'd be no protest. Not even from Cedric. I straightened up. Do you think I should? It's not what I think that matters. But I know you've had your sights set high, and this is about as high as you can get. It would certainly speak well for my future. I mean, that is what we're here for. Although we didn't have to take the highest bidder's offer, a man putting down a lot of money generally suggested he had the means to provide generously for his wife. It gave the Thorns a higher commission, and also increased the bride's surety money. Although, it was kind of presumptuous coming in here like that, wanting to buy the best right now. Mira laughed. It certainly was, though even he seemed to recognize that. There was a brazen and bumbling charm to it. At least he wasn't one of the ones asking if he could buy the Sir Minikin at a discount. I squeezed her hand. That was an offer we'd heard many times. It was nice that he seemed more concerned with my character than my looks. He already saw you. He doesn't have to worry about your looks. But you wouldn't take the deal. You still want to pay off your own contract, she shrugged. I told you, it's not about what I think. But no, I'd do as Cedric said and see the rest of my options. You can still choose him later. Tamsin would have taken the deal, I said sadly. Tamsin would have called for a priest and offered to marry him on the spot, Mira said. My heart sank. Tamsin should have been the one getting the offer. She should have been the diamond. Word reached me later that Cedric had won out against his father. I wouldn't be meeting Warren until the ball. I suspected Jasper had caved in the hopes that, seeing me with other men, Warren might end up offering more. In the coming days, as the household was whipped into the frenzy Cedric had predicted, I found I had mixed feelings about what had happened with Warren. I respected what Cedric had fought for. On the other hand, I worried I might have cost Cedric the commission he needed. Really, what else was there to look for? Marrying Warren would put me in the closest position I could get to my former lifestyle here in the colonies. Haddison was in no danger from the Ikori. It was simply unsettled land, needing a society to thrive in it and work its gold mines. Somehow, amidst the pre-ball tumult, I found a chance to finish the painting when Mistress Culpepper was away. A small window in the cellar offered remarkably good light, and stepping back one day I was astonished that I really had captured Theodorus's style. It was my greatest work. An inexperienced buyer certainly wouldn't know any different. An art expert probably wouldn't. The cellar door creaked open, and I turned with a start, relaxing when I saw Cedric come down the stairs. He stopped next to me and stared. "That's it," he said. "That's it," I confirmed. Amazing. I thought the poppies were incredible the day we met, but this is something else altogether. He continued studying it, transfixed. I'll smuggle this out of here tonight, over to my agent. He'll evaluate it, and let me know what he thinks it'll get. But something tells me it'll be high, enough to cover my Westhaven stake. You know what else would have helped with your stake? I asked archly.
A 20% commission on 1,000 gold. Cedric turned from the painting and met my eyes.
Really? You came all this way, and prepared for a season of galas only to skip them and marry the first man who wants you? Without even meeting him?
I would have met him eventually, I argued, and I never said that's what I want. I'm just surprised you've taken such a stand. I thought securing an offer like that was top priority.
Securing your self-respect is top priority. I didn't bring you into the glittering court so that you could be packed off to the first man who demands you.
Hey, I retorted, I brought myself into the glittering court.
You're confirming my point. You're too strong, too opinionated, to just let yourself go with the first offer. You deserve more. You deserve to have them lined up in front of you. Maybe you'll want him, after all, and that's completely fine, even if it results in a lower fee. Or maybe you'll like some other man. Maybe a few other men. Maybe there'll be a bidding war. Maybe someone will beat his offer.
Maybe. But I find that last one unlikely. And I bet your father thinks it's unlikely, too.
Cedric sighed.
He does.
The substantial sum aside, he thought it best we get you signed and engaged before you open your mouth and ruin your chances.
His words, not mine.
What? I said, not even bothering to hide my indignation. We'll see about that. There are going to be plenty of men who like a woman who speaks her mind.
I agree. I certainly like your mouth.
Cedric suddenly seemed to reconsider his words. That's not what I... Look, I just want you to have all your options. You deserve that.
And I want you to stay alive.
Me too.
He turned back to the painting and sighed. And between this, your charms, and a little luck, we might just pull it all off.
Chapter 14. The days to the opening ball somehow managed to fly by, and yet feel endlessly long. I still grieved for Tamsin, but the pre-ball frenzy allowed me to keep those dark feelings at bay. This was what everything in the glittering court had been building up to. It wasn't unheard of for girls to make marriage deals on that first night. Others would go through the season assessing and accruing offers.
"I just want to get out of this house," Mira said when the day finally came. "We're here in the biggest, most cosmopolitan city of the New World, but haven't seen any of it."
I thought of the ramshackle houses and muddy roads we'd passed on our first day. I think cosmopolitan might be an exaggeration.
"We only saw the harbor.
The city center is entirely different, lively and busy and full of wonders."
"How do you know that?" I asked.
She shrugged. "Word of mouth."
I paced in front of the large mirror in our bedroom, a luxury in Adoria. We'd been outfitted for hours, and were now waiting for the call to get in the coaches. Mistress Culpepper had wanted no last-minute wardrobe surprises. Mira and I stood in stark contrast to each other. I wore silk of brilliant white, just like a bride. Silver lace peeped around the low neckline and spilled from the elbow-length sleeves. Tiny crystals, echoing diamonds, decorated the bodice in a filigree pattern, and then spilled across the overdress's skirts like stars. Actual diamonds hung from my neck and ears, coming from a shared collection of jewelry used each year. Elaborate, often colored wigs were fashionable in Adoria, but both Miss Bradley and Mistress Culpepper had been adamant I not wear any. "Keeping with your theme would put you in white or grey," Mistress Culpepper had explained. "We don't want that. We need to show you as young and vibrant."
"It'll make you look more Osfridian for this first event, which isn't a bad thing," added Miss Bradley. "We want to be part of this society, obviously, but it's important you represent the old world, too, which is, of course, the pinnacle of fashion and culture."
So part of my hair was pulled up in the Adorian way, with the rest of it cascading in long curls in the Osfridian way. Strands of crystals had been woven into my hair, and everywhere I turned I sparkled. Mira's dress, also of silk, was a deep blood-red, with a lower neckline than mine. The skirt opened in the front, revealing a ruffled black petticoat, a highly unusual colour choice that had made Mistress Culpepper raise an eyebrow. The seamstresses in Osfrid had insisted it would look striking with the rest of the outfit, and they were right.
multifaceted beads of sparkling jet trimmed her neckline and sleeves, rather than the usual lace. Her hair, worn down, was adorned with a matching black crystal band from which hung strands of deep red hair that mingled seamlessly with her natural black. With Mira's rank unexpectedly moved up, the glittering quartz heads were trying to pass her off as a ruby, rather than a garnet now. Mira came to stand with me in the mirror, and smoothed the red locks with a frown.
"Do you think these are real? Am I wearing some other woman's hair?"
"Does it matter when you look so stunning?" I asked.
Mira's expression told me it did matter, but she didn't pursue the topic.
"Good luck," she said. "Not that you'll need it. You've already got an offer."
"You'll have plenty, too," I assured her, my mind wandering to Warren. I'd been so uncertain that first day, wondering if I should have taken the deal. Now I'd had more time to think, and I was glad Cedric had intervened. I wanted my options, even if it meant I might have sacrificed an unheard-of payment. A call outside the door told us it was time to go. We squeezed each other's hands. No hugs, as that might wrinkle the dresses, and hurried to join the others. They, too, were a bright, sparkling array of jewels, some with natural hair, like me, and others with coloured wigs. Clara wore a sunflower yellow one that I thought looked kind of awful. Mistress Culpepper and Miss Bradley gave us one more inspection.
"Remember," said Miss Bradley, "keep powdering. Don't let your makeup run or turn greasy."
"And," added Mistress Culpepper sharply, "behave pristinely the entire night. I do not expect to see any of you frequenting the wine or punch."
Extra servants, guards, and carriages had been hired for this trip. We were put two to a coach in order to leave enough room for our dresses. Temporary maids came along in another carriage, ready to help any of us who needed primping at the ball. Still another carriage was loaded with extra dresses, wigs, and jewelry, should an emergency occur. I didn't see the Thorns, but knew they would be coming in their own carriage. It being early evening, we could still see out the windows, and both Mira and I studied our surroundings eagerly. We passed other houses, none so big as ours, and I was again struck by the newness and jumbled layout. In Osfrid, even in a rural area like this, with lots of land, each home's plot would be precisely laid out, with clear boundaries, often with small stone walls to separate them. Everything would be claimed. Here it was as though people had built at random, and didn't seem to care about ownership. And of course there were trees. Always trees. They thinned out a little as we reached the heart of Cape Triumph. And here I found Mira was right. Cobblestones covered the narrow roads, and the buildings were higher, with a greater sense of permanence. Shops of all kinds lined the streets, as well as places of entertainment, some looking more reputable than others. With evening approaching, brightly coloured lanterns lit up the doorways. Groups of people moved through the street, displaying a diverse variety of backgrounds as they came home from work or sought evening entertainment. Most were dressed humbly, or showed signs of the middle class, but obviously affluent citizens walked right among them, with no indication there was anything unusual. And rich or poor, many seemed to make their own fashion choices, defying both Adorian and Osfridian customs. The populace was exotic, and lively, and impossible to look away from. In keeping with Adorian demographics, the majority of those I saw were men.
"I would love to get out and explore this," said Mira.
"I don't think Mistress Culpepper would approve."
The streets didn't look unsafe exactly, but it was certainly no place any of us would be allowed to go alone, especially after some of the behaviour I'd observed at the docks.
I pointed toward a man standing on a corner, wearing a deep green uniform.
"Hey, a soldier. That's the first I've seen. I'd think there'd be more."
Mira followed my gaze.
"They're around, but not as many as there used to be, now that most outside threats are gone."
"Then who keeps order inside? The militia?" I asked. Cape Triumph had no official city guard, as Osfro did. The military was usually charged with primary law enforcement in the colonies, with the rest delegated to volunteer and locally organized groups.
"Them? Other agents of the Crown?
Pirates?"
"Aren't pirates, by definition, breaking the law?"
"Not always. Haven't you heard how some of them walk the streets and help people in danger?"
Mira's face was alight, caught up in the heroic drama she loved.
"No. When did you hear that?"
I talk to the guards sometimes. It's more interesting than listening to all the visiting suitors.
Oh, you mean the visiting suitors who will play an influential role in your future?
Those are the ones, she answered with a grin.
Our destination was a vast hall on the opposite side of downtown. It was large, wooden, and plain. Nothing at all like the grand ballrooms of Osfrid that were housed in ancient estates and castles. But this was apparently the largest place for a social function, and as we took in the crowds and guests gathered out front, I hoped it would be big enough to hold everyone. Our carriages travelled to a back door so that we could enter in private. We gathered in an antechamber inside, and were subjected to another inspection as Mistress Culpepper made sure our dresses and hairstyles had survived the journey. I spotted the Thorns, huddled together, joined by a tall woman I'd never seen before. At first I thought she was Sir Minikin, with her black hair and dusky complexion. But there was something about her that was different. The set of her high cheekbones, and a general sense of otherness. Her outfit, though made of nice fabric, resembled a riding dress with split skirts. It seemed out of place here, as did her hair, lying in one long braid down her back. That wasn't fashionable anywhere. I turned back and started to say something to Mira about it when I discovered that Cedric had come up beside us. His hands were in the pockets of a long, fitted, knee-length coat of a steel-blue damask that enhanced his grey eyes. I'd never seen him in that colour, and was struck by the effect. It set off the auburn of his hair, and could have easily passed him off as Osfridian nobility, except that I'd never met any noble who made me suddenly feel so flushed and warm. I realized then that Cedric was staring at me too, and that maybe, just maybe, I wasn't the only one feeling flushed.
"You clean up well," I said.
"So do you."
"Like you've ever seen me not clean up well."
"Well, I've seen you when you're..." He stopped, realizing Mira was here. "When you're in less elaborate outfits, like that, one time."
"Of course you'd bring that up."
I took a bold step toward him and twirled to show off the decadence of the dress. But this is a serious improvement. It's like a dream. Not so much that other outfit. "Well," he looked me over in a way that made my blush deepen. "I guess it depends on the type of dream." Mira cleared her throat and asked,
"Is everything okay with your family? I thought I saw you and your father arguing earlier."
That seemed to pull him back to the present, and he finally looked away from me. "Just more of our usual dysfunction. We were discussing who'd do Adelaide's introductions. He wanted to, but I argued it should be me. As you're my... acquisition." It was a term he'd always used freely in the past, but he stumbled over it tonight. "And," I prompted, "I won." I grinned. "When don't you?" A rueful look crossed his face. "Well, it's on the condition that you meet Warren Doyle first. So long as I arrange that, my father's fine with everything else." After we made our grand procession in the room, interested suitors would approach Glittering Court representatives to arrange dances and conversations with us. It was to prevent us from being mobbed.
"Are you making mine too?"
asked Mira. Cedric shook his head and gestured to the tall woman. "Ayana is..." Mira studied the woman curiously.
"Who is she?"
"She's Balanquan," he said. "Does various jobs for us." Mira and I exchanged astonished looks. The Balanquan people, like the Ikori, had been in Adoria when Osfridians and others from across the Sunset Sea had arrived. There had been no wars or territorial disputes with the Balanquans as there had with the Ikori. This was partially due to their northern lands being less hospitable, and partially because they made a more formidable enemy than the less advanced Ikori. Their culture was supposed to be sophisticated and rich, albeit very foreign from ours.
"What is she doing here?"
asked Mira. The Balanquans had attempted some arbitration for the Ikori and Osfridians, but mostly stayed away from us. "Uncle Charles contracts her," Cedric explained. "Usually her job is following up with girls after they've married. If she sees anything amiss, or any bad treatment, she deals with it." Before we could ask for more details, Mistress Culpepper called us into formation to make our grand entrance. Just as before, I would lead.
My hands began to shake with nervousness, and I fiercely fought for control. I'd been announced and entered alone in countless parties back in Osfrid. I was no stranger to crowds or displays, unlike many of the other girls. They might have completed their training. They might look the part of nobility. But what we were about to do was beyond what many of them had ever experienced. Some were pale, others trembling. Mistress Culpepper told me to go. I wished I could see Mira and get one last look of encouragement, but she was in line behind me and out of sight. Then I caught sight of Cedric standing near the door. He met my eyes and nodded. I stepped forward.
"Adelaide Bailey! Diamond!" someone announced.
The hall might have been simple in nature, but the Thorns had gone to a lot of expense and labour to convince the guests otherwise. Flowers and candles, linen and crystal. If not for the rough wooden walls and exposed beams above, this could have passed for an affair back home. A walkway had been cleared through the room for us to proceed to a raised dais on the opposite side. Guests lined the aisle, orderly and quiet, with none of the coarseness from the docks. These were the elite of Adoria, well-dressed with wine-glasses in hand as they studied us politely. Women were mingled in the crowd, mothers hoping to help their sons, or society ladies who were simply curious. I walked smoothly, serenely. I was the best of the glittering court. I was the new nobility and the old nobility, the descendant of Osfrid's founders. Soon I would take my place with Adoria's founders. This was what all my struggles and manipulation had been for. As Diamond, I would meet the city's most elite. I would attend the most exclusive functions, and I would pull in the highest price and commission ever seen by any of the Thorn's jewels. I reached the dais where one of Jasper's hired men helped me ascend the steps in my elaborate dress. I took my place at the center of a long table, which held glasses of water. Mistress Culpepper wouldn't allow us to eat here, so we'd had to do it beforehand. Although the next girl was making her entrance, I saw many eyes still on me, and I met them as confidently as Osfrid's queen might have. Mira drew a lot of attention when she entered. In my opinion, she was the most beautiful of the group. Jasper might have grumbled, but I had no doubts that many men would be glad to have her as a wife, Sir Minikin or not. Thinking of her spirited nature, I thought the trouble might come in her consenting to be a wife. It made me smile, just as I met Warren Doyle's eyes in the crowd. He smiled back, thinking I'd done it for him. When we were all seated, the high society decorum degenerated a little. Cedric, Jasper, Charles, and Ayana were immediately solicited for introductions, with suitors and their representatives lining up to get a chance at us. Mira, seated on my left, remarked,
"It's going to be a long night."
Despite what seemed like initial disorder, things soon progressed. Cedric came for me and took my arm, escorting me across the floor.
"Ready to meet your greatest admirer?" he asked.
"I thought you were my greatest admirer."
"I'm just a humble man, not an absurdly rich and doting future statesman."
I studied Warren Doyle as we approached. His face was alight, and he shifted excitedly from foot to foot. His coat was cut like Cedric's, fitted and buttoned to the neck in a bronze shade. He looked like he was trying to remain calm and serious, but his face broke into a grin as we grew closer.
"If it makes you feel better," I said softly, "I like your coat better." "Well, don't tell the poor guy. I think he'd burst into tears if he knew you thought less of him."
I managed to stop myself from laughing, but a grin still crept out, which Warren again thought was for him. "Mr. Warren Doyle," said Cedric, with no trace of his prior teasing, "may I present Miss Adelaide Bailey?" I gave the delicate curtsy driven into us at Loosespring, and Warren took my hand, still smiling broadly as he shook it.
"I know I should be more decorous, but I can't help it. I'm just too excited. You probably think I'm uncivilized."
I smiled back, amused at his nervous eagerness. "Not at all, Mr. Doyle." Cedric gave a small bow and a wink to me that Warren didn't see.
"I'll leave you two to talk, and then I'll come back for your next introduction."
He left just as the string quartet began to play. Warren held out his hand and swept me into a dance.
"You must call me Warren," he said. "I like to be straightforward."
"That's what I hear. You may call me Adelaide."
"I know our time tonight is brief.
and I know you'll have a dozen men trying to turn your head with all sorts of charm and pleasantry." He paused. "I'm not always so good at that. At idle small talk. Simply for appearance's sake. I know some ladies like that, but as I said, you're straightforward," I finished. "Exactly. If I know what I want, I pursue it. And I'll be honest. I want you. While we were waiting for your ship to arrive, I knew without a doubt I would come asking for the star of your cohort. Seeing you at the dock only confirmed my decision. And seeing you now..." He shook his head. "Well, I'll tell you simply. I didn't look at any of the other girls out there tonight. You truly are a diamond. And I can't imagine any other wife but you." Even knowing what I did about him, I was a bit overwhelmed.
"Wow. You come on very...
straightforward?" I laughed. "Yes, but I think strong was what I had in mind. Or maybe intense. You're very kind, very flattering. But I don't know that I deserve this when we hardly know each other." He looked abashed and missed a step, but I was quick enough to recover for both of us. "I know, I know. And I'm sorry. I sound like a desperate fool. But I'm... you know what I'm facing, right? Governorship of Hattison? At only 23? I've heard that as well. A great honor." "And a terrifying one," he admitted. He glanced around uneasily. "I haven't told anyone that. Certainly not my father, who helped secure the post. I'm glad, I really am. But it's not going to be easy. And I don't just mean the labor of setting up the colony, which is certainly formidable. I want Hattison to be a strong place. A good place, of upstanding and prosperous citizens. Not everyone will let me do that. People are always watching you in politics, always wanting you to fail, even when they pretend to be your friends." I didn't speak and simply gave him a nod of encouragement, but he'd touched upon an old memory. The way the nobility in Osford also put on pleasant faces only to attack when advantageous. Even across the sea, some things didn't change. And I found myself growing sympathetic to Warren Doyle. "I have colleagues and advisors I think I can trust, but one can never be sure," he continued. "And that's why I need a smart, competent wife, my true ally. The one person I know I can trust, to give me good counsel while helping me keep up appearances with fashion and culture and all the other things the elite like to pick apart."
"I don't think you need much help with fashion and culture."
No matter what I'd said to Cedric, Warren was dressed exceptionally. "I'm surrounded by powerful family here, and a mother who keeps up with trends. There, I'll have nothing. Except you. And believe me when I'd say, you'd have all you could dream of. Luxury at your fingertips, complete control of the household. Again, flattering," I said. "But you don't know anything about me aside from my rank. There's more to marriage than that. How do you know we're... compatible?" His answer was swift. "Because you haven't instantly said yes. You're a thinking woman. A woman who can assess things. And that, Adelaide, is exactly what I'm looking for. What I most admire." Cedric appeared at our side the instant the music ended. "Adelaide, it's time for your next introduction." Warren caught hold of my hand as I stepped away. "Please, consider my offer. I know I must sound desperate, and I'm certainly doing this all wrong." "Please, Mr. Doyle," said Cedric. He seemed a little surprised, but mostly amused at what he no doubt considered more of Warren's dizzy infatuation. "It's time for her to go." Warren didn't release me, even when I tried to remove my hand. "You'll hear all sorts of offers tonight, all sorts of pretty words. You're beautiful beyond compare. But ask yourself, how many want you for your wisdom? To be a partner." Cedric's smile was gone. "Mr. Doyle, your time is up." Warren was undaunted. "And how many will match the lifestyle I can give you? The queen of a colony." "That's enough," exclaimed Cedric, losing the civility. "You are not above the rules here, no matter your rank or resources, Mr. Doyle. We've set down specific guidelines, and if you can't follow them, our guards will have to remove you." Cedric forcibly pulled me away, causing Warren to stumble and look understandably astonished. "Did you just hear yourself?" I exclaimed, once Cedric had led me away. "I did, and so did several people nearby. You'd better hope your father doesn't find out what you just said." I don't care about him. Cedric's dark expression showed he no longer found Warren Doyle amusing. That's twice now Doyle's been out of line.
One last impassioned plea wasn't exactly out of line, I countered. You could have been a little more diplomatic.